You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM at KVON.com.
Time once again for the one and only Mike Schaefer on film, actor, acting coach, fan of the movies. Mike Schaefer, welcome back.
Barry Martin, do you know what we were doing, what we were working on 6 years ago?
6 years ago, right now in February, it had to have been Bonnie and Clyde.
We were working on Bonnie and Clyde. Seems like 1,000 years ago.
Doesn't it?
Today. It really does, sadly. So today's episode, Barry Martin, today's episode is called The Good, The Bad, and The Ugly. We have four movies to I know. Thank you. The great composer, Ennio Morricone. We've got four films to unpack today, so let's get started, shall we? With The Good. Starting off, the film is called Let Him Go. It is a 2020 neo-Western, which pretty much means it's set in 1963 instead of 1863. It's directed by Thomas Bezekel. I think I'm pronouncing his name right. He has other credits, movies that literally could have been directed by anybody. This movie feels a lot more personal. And I'm going to go on a limb and say this is a minor classic. It is. I've recommended other movies already on the show. I think if this were a night where you, Barry Martin, had some time to watch a movie based on a recommendation of mine, I think you would really, really enjoy Let Him Go.
I am going to surprise you because when I saw it was on your list to review this week, I watched it last night.
Oh, my goodness.
I did.
Oh,
I invested $4.99 and watched that film. I want to hear what you think, and then I'll give you some of my thoughts.
Okay. So as you already know, Kevin Costner and Diane Lane play grandparents. And look, I got to stop right here because – I mean, even now, someone walks up to me and mentions Diane Lane's name to me. Mm-hmm. I still think she's Matt Dillon's girlfriend from The Outsiders. I'm like, 2020 has been hard on everybody, yeah. But when did this happen?
Right.
But so, I, you know, the plot is, and, you know, you already are familiar, but for our friends in Radioland, their son, recently married, dies, unfortunately, in a horseback riding accident. Their grandson, whom Diane Lane has bonded with very strongly, and perhaps mostly because she's still mourning the loss of her son, their ex-daughter-in-law now has remarried. And the gentleman she marries is an abusive jerk. In fact, Diane Lane actually sees him one day slapping the child in the middle of the street. And then the very next day, it seems, the movie, that family moves. They move back to Montana where he has family, a mother and several brothers. So she comes back to Costner, who is a retired lawman, and says, look, I packed the car. We're driving to Montana. I just need to know that he's okay. You know, Costner's resistant at first, but he loves his wife. He loves his grandson. He's more of a realist. You know, he's basically thinking, what can we do? Really? She's remarried. But they do. We follow their journey. They are both solid, dependable. And I'll tell you something. If Westerns were as popular today in 2020, 2021, as they were, say, in their heyday of the 50s, I think Kevin Costner and Diane Lane would probably be two of the biggest movie stars in the world. They are so natural. For the genre, they bring such gravitas, and Costner in particular, you know, he's made some bad career choices here and there, but he's really become this sort of Western archetype, right? The sort of strong, silent, Gary Cooper-esque. Diane Lane, also very good. She more or less, both literally and figuratively, drives the movie.
Yeah.
But, and I hope you agree with this next part, but I think the MVP for this movie in particular is the woman who plays Blanche.
Yeah.
Leslie Manville, who unrecognizable British character actress who plays this sort of Ma Barker like character, and she's raising these boys who you know, they make the Menendez brothers look like the Marx brothers, you know. They're just utterly deplorable. the movie feels very mythic to me, like particularly when they enter the third act. It's almost like they're, you know, this family really lives off the grid, but it's almost like descending into hell. The movie does take a surprising darker tone. I won't get into spoilers. I thought the score was elegiac, magnificent. I B plus for Mike Schaefer. I was very, very pleased with this
film. Yeah. I'm not quite as excited about it as you are, although my reasons may be too picky for the genre. But it's the same flaw I find in a lot of stories of this nature. We're not given any understanding of why the bad people are so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that leaves me always wanting more. Like, you know, the complexity of the story is lacking when you don't understand anything about the villain, you know?
Yeah.
So then it becomes just, you know, two-dimensional. The performances were outstanding, just around, you know, without fail. Every single person I thought was amazingly good.
Uh-huh.
And I was fascinated by it, and I wanted to learn more, and I cared about people. But yeah, Ma Barker was a great comparison, like Ma Barker with the Clantons from Tombstone, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's another great story that, you know, the Tombstone story is told over and over again. Do we ever get under the surface to know why the Clantons were so mean?
Mm-hmm. And there are several versions of, in fact, Costner made Wyatt Earp the same year that Tombstone came out, which is arguably the better film.
Right, and when you understand a little bit about the Clantons and what their motivation is, the whole thing gets better for me.
Yeah, there's a revisionist Western from 1971 called Doc, which really makes the Clantons much more sympathetic and turns Wyatt into a villain. It's a very interesting film. Mm. But I thought Manville absolutely needs to be in the conversation for Best Supporting Actress.
Yeah, for sure.
She was magnificent.
Yeah.
Just dripping with evil. I just loved her so much.
Chillingly mean. So the film is called Let Him Go, and I would have to say, not quite as big a fan as Mike, but it's worth the $4.99.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Right.
Moving on. So initially I was hesitant to say the title of this movie.
I gave you permission.
Thank you. Barry Martin throwing, he's a man, ladies and gentlemen, throwing caution to the wind. It's called Shit House. And I think when I sat down to watch it, didn't know a whole lot going in. Okay. I knew that it had won Best Narrative Feature at South by Southwest last year. And I think, Barry, I was half expecting a sort of Gen Z, Gen X, Gen Y. I'm not sure. I think one of them is a brand of detergent. I'm not sure. But kind of Animal House. For millennials, for 2020. And although it is set in a college and there are frat parties and fart jokes, it's really quite a bittersweet, poignant, romantic movie. It is written, this is the directorial debut of a young man named Cooper Rafe. He plays a 19-year-old freshman at Occidental College. He's somewhat, he's struggling with being a freshman. He's chosen to move from Texas to California. He's very bonded with his family. His father has recently passed away, unfortunately. Goes to a party, finally talks himself into going to a party because he's really finally, when we meet him, he's finally coming to understand that he needs to try a little harder to connect with his classes, to connect with people. And, you know, meets a girl. She's very much enjoying her independence. They hook up, sort of, and he's immediately like, let's commit. I'm in love with you. And she's like, whoa, dude, chill, right? So if the film has a criticism for me, it meanders a little bit. That's really not so much a criticism as it is an appreciation of the filmmakers, once again, taking the time too, because we were just talking about Let Him Go. Maybe we could have seen more, have more of an understanding of why people behave the way they do. But we do spend a considerable amount of time getting to know these two characters and their burgeoning love story. I was quite impressed with it. And I will say this, you know, typically the hero of a quote unquote a hipster comedy or an indie film, Sundance darling, you know, they tend to be kind of smirky, you know, smirking their way through the performance. They always have a smart alecky comeback. And the character that Rafe plays is very real, Barry. He's emotionally present in every scene. He's actually, they allow the character to show, to project more vulnerability than you would normally see. And I really, really appreciated that. So also another name to look forward to in the future is the young lady who plays the girlfriend, for want of a better word. Her name is Dylan Galula. She also does really, really good work. So solid debut from Mr. Cooper Rafe.
All right.
The movie is Shithouse. And I just like saying that.
If anyone is offended, well, you know, it's 2021. What can I say? Where is that film available?
VOD. Okay. And I think it is a $4.99 that is worth it. I think that people will be pleasantly surprised. And if there were one title, interestingly enough, to sort of define 2020, would be this one. Would be Shithouse. And it's too bad. It's too bad theaters aren't open, because I'd love to see what theater owners do with the marquee in trying to advertise the title of this movie. But we don't have that right now.
The Legion of Decency would be having trouble with it.
They would. Yeah. Yeah.
On we go. Film number three.
Okay. So once again, right, this title is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Now we're at the bad. So brace yourself, Barry. And I think you know where I'm going.
I do.
Hillbilly Elegy.
Yeah.
Maybe that's all I need to say. We're moving on. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget to tip your waiter. You've read the book. You're familiar with the book, yes?
You know, I think in retrospect, I think I listened to the book. I think it was an audio book.
Okay. I have not read the book. But I think there, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find somebody in the world who isn't familiar with the book and familiar with the author. I finally got around to watching the movie. And you know, I've seen some of the other reviews. Okay. I've read some articles, you know, digested content, and the consensus of most of the people who've seen the film and didn't like it. Okay. And this is a bad movie. All right. I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not, you know, trying to make it more than it is, but you know, the consensus was that Ron Howard was absolutely the wrong choice to direct Hillbilly Elegy.
I think I could cast a vote for that thought.
Okay. Now, here's what's interesting. And I gave that some thought, and I thought, you know what? I think these folks are only half right. So I'm coming at this from a different perspective. So when Ron Howard was first starting out as a filmmaker, the guy that gave him his first job was Roger Corman. Okay. So we're now in 1977. Ron Howard made a car chase movie called Grand Theft Auto, and then he made a second one called Eat My Dust for Corman. Mm-hmm. Corman made exploitation movies, right? So, and he's also responsible for not just Ron Howard, but for the careers of several A-list directors, including Martin Scorsese. So if you're a young, hungry filmmaker just coming out of USC, whatever, you could work for Corman under certain conditions, right? There's a budget. Don't even think about going over budget. And there's got to be something exploitive, something exciting that happens literally every 10 minutes. I've got to put that on the poster. I've got to cut a trailer. Okay. We're not making art films. Now, you can say whatever you like. If you want to make an anti-war film, fine. If you want to make a pro-drug film, fine. But I need nudity. I need car chases. I need shootouts every 10 minutes. So Ron Howard directed a big budget exploitation film, because I don't know about the book, but the movie has something happening, some outburst, somebody getting the snot kicked out of them, someone being set on fire. Yes, that does happen in the movie literally every 10 minutes. The problem here is that there's no connecting tissue. Things just happen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so once again, never boring. But, you know, you're sitting there watching a nice scene, you know, playing cards with grandma, you know, and the next thing you know, Amy Adams in the middle of the street, you know, apparently attempting suicide, mm-hmm. screaming. There are cops. Where did this come from? And then in the very next scene, it's never mentioned again.
Yeah, I swear, it's like the Jerry Springer Show without any of the fun.
Yeah.
You know? It's just all the yelling and the fighting and the crying. And I was interested in the film because I did get something from the audiobook version, which is narrated by the author. And he became sort of a semi-celebrity around this book, which is sort of a modern version of the Waltons in a way.
Yeah.
Because Earl Hamner was writing about his memories of growing up in Appalachia, right?
Right.
So this guy, I can't recall the author's name, but he was doing the same thing. He's looking back at his growing up years and reflecting on it. And at the same time, he was trying to make commentary on why it is the way it is there. All the economic factors and the lack of hope and all these different issues and the health care problems. It was like it was meaningful stuff.
Yeah.
And all of that is gone out of the movie. There's none of that depth of meaningful content. It's just this constant yelling at each other thing.
They made a deliberate choice to depoliticize, if that's a word, the movie. The movie has no bite. I don't want to call J.D. Vance an apologist.
There you go,
for
J.D. Vance.
Appalachia, you know, or an understanding for liberals to, you know, why did the so-called flyover states turn to Trump in 2016? Mm-hmm. Having some bite, having some political gravitas in the movie could have helped the film.
Absolutely. It would have,
in my opinion.
It would have counterbalanced all the Jerry Springer elements.
The yelling and the screaming and the meltdowns every 10 minutes. But it makes sense to hire a guy who came up through exploitation films.
Yeah, I get that.
So, you know, and you know, the SAG nominations came out last week, Amy Adams, and I kind of called this. Amy Adams and Glenn Close were nominated. And here's the thing. I don't think their performances are bad. I just think the way the movie was edited makes them look like clowns.
Yep. And didn't Glenn Close look like Cloris Leachman doing a skit?
Yes, she did. Yes, I saw that too.
Oh, man. It's disturbing.
Cloris Leachman, when she was the grandmother in Bad Santa, I thought, oh, you look like that.
Right?
Grandma seems very spry.
You know, and it was not very good.
Yeah, but actors know. You know, I appreciate the hard work. It's just that the way the script was written, and also I would like to see the litany of other writers who contributed the screenplay, and I'm wondering why it was just one woman who was singled out for abuse, because she's done quality work before. But not a good movie, not a boring movie, but it's a bad movie.
Hillbilly Elegy does not sound recommended. Where could someone watch it if they had the bad judgment to do so?
If they haven't, if they've literally got nothing better to do and are masochists, yes, they can find it on Netflix.
Okay. It's got 26% on Rotten Tomatoes, by the way.
And it's well deserved, by the way.
And so this last film is also in the not so good category, sounds like.
We finally reached the ugly part of the show. I just hated Malcolm and Marie. Malcolm and Marie dropped on Netflix, Friday. It is directed by some guy named Sam Levinson. Now, his dad is Hollywood big shot director Barry Levinson, who directed three, I think, of the best movies of the 80s, Rain Man, Good Morning Vietnam, and I think his masterpiece, which is Diner, okay? So Barry Levinson did three great things. He also did one really bad thing. He made Sam Levinson. And then Sam Levinson did a really terrible thing. He wrote and directed Malcolm and Marie. So the production is more interesting than the movie itself because it was shot in secret, quote unquote, during the pandemic. It was shot in June over the course of 2 weeks. Zendaya, who's in the movie, who is breathtaking, by the way. She's a true movie star in the sense that, you know, the camera loves her. And the cinematography, black and white, gorgeous, okay? It's if you watch the trailer, you're thinking, oh, this is like a stormy relationship, a romantic film. I loved the soundtrack. I get the plot, such as it is this is the night of The character of Malcolm is a film director, and he's just premiered a new movie, and you know, very excited about the reviews that he has received in person at the premiere. But something is troubling Marie, and we get to that, and what ensues is pretty much an hour and 45 minutes of arguing and screaming, bad acting, pontificating, occasionally taking a break to pee outside and make macaroni and cheese, and then argue some more. But that's not the real problem. And this gets into some dicey territory, so bear with me for a second, if you may. Sam Levinson had directed a film called Assassination Nation, which was panned by a film critic named Katie Walsh, okay? In the movie, Malcolm is going on and on and on, ad nauseum about, now once again, remember, he is a black filmmaker. His thesis, at least in his head, is that white film critics in particular are not able to accurately review movies directed by black filmmakers unless they can look at the movie through the prism of racial politics, okay? So he's basically saying someone like Spike Lee can't just make a Lego movie because a white critic might say, oh, well, this is really about civil rights. It's not just a Lego movie. They couldn't just make... There's something to be said for that. There is a level of truth. The problem is that Levinson, who is white, is using his black character as a mouthpiece for his own pettiness. This is a 1 hour and 45 minute hit job against white film critics in general, and specifically one, she's unnamed in the movie. He keeps referring to her in the B word, the unnamed white film critic lady from the LA Times. He's really talking about Katie Walsh. So if it weren't for the fact that Levinson is the son of a big shot Hollywood director, he'd be a guy, he clearly needs therapy. And he'd also be asking me if I'd like fries with my or parking my car.
Yeah.
And here's the thing, Barry, a movie can be offensive. I'm not troubled by offensive movies. I'm a John Waters fan, for example. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing that you can never do, and I hope that you agree with me on this, you could do anything. You can scare your audience, offend your audience, you know, delight your audience, turn on your audience. Just don't be boring. Never bore your audience. Mm-hmm. And why this movie is like Hillbilly Elegy, step aside, because the worst movie of 2020 is, I mean, everybody associated with Hillbilly Elegy needs to take out the entire crew, which is about 20 people, I think, to dinner and say thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm and Marie, for keeping us from being the worst.
Just hated it.
That's nice. Mike Schaefer on Film, ladies and gentlemen. We're all out of time, but thanks for hitting four popular or not so popular films that are on demand or on Netflix. And a great show as usual. We'll talk
to you
next
sir.
Week, huh?
Looking forward to it. Thanks,
all right.
Barry.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Very good work.
You're listening to the Wine Country Live Morning Show with Barry Martin
on KVON Napa, 1440 AM and KVON.com.